Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Carulla and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Hollywood. This is your host Nikki Carulla with Ronan Rosner sitting in for Eddie Pence. How are you, Ronan?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Are you excited for the holidays?
I am. As a Jew, you know, I got 8 days ahead of me.
So Hanukkah this year is on the 24th, right?
It's actually Christmas Day.
Oh, okay.
Is the first candle, yeah.
So do you open gifts in the morning or at night? Usually at night, right?
Yeah.
You do one a day, right?
When you light the candles. Yeah, I mean, some people do. What we usually do is buy, like, little, you know, knickknacks to get through the week, and then a big present sometimes.
At the end?
Yeah, or sometimes in the beginning.
Your kids probably want it at the beginning. Like, give us the big one now so we can play with it for a week earlier, and then we can party. Do you do anything traditional for food? What do you do for food?
Oh, yeah. We got our version of donuts.
I'm going to your place.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'll bring you. They're amazing. It's basically the same. That's that, like, the fried dough.
Yeah.
We fill it up with, traditionally it was, you know, like jam, but now you got all sorts of, you know, Nutella.
Wow. Really?
Yeah.
Wait, can I order these? Like, where?
Of course.
Where do you get them?
I mean, you're in.
But I go to the West Side.
Go to Fairfax.
What's the best place to get them?
I don't know over there, but any.
What about A Lot Bakery? There's a bakery on the West Side.
Yep. Try those.
Because there's tons of bakeries on Pico. I used to live there, so
yep.
I never knew that. So is that only around Hanukkah they make
those?
Yes,
that's when they usually do it.
That is awesome.
And then there's the traditional latke, which is basically those...
The potato. Pancakes.
Yeah, exactly.
And you eat it with sour cream and applesauce?
Me, I just like it like that.
Straight.
Yeah.
No meats?
Nothing specific.
You don't do a turkey? Yeah. Like, a lot of Americans do turkey or ham.
No. The thing is with Hanukkah is not a religious holiday. It's more of the history.
Right.
So, I mean...
It's the Festival of Lights.
Something like that.
Yeah. The Festival of Lights, man.
I mean, if you really want to experience it, you have to go to Jerusalem.
Right.
And you see all those menorahs and, you know, the candles and the windows. And over there, they do it like, really, they got those... It's not like regular candles. It's that actual oil.
Yeah.
And they put the fuse in.
Because that's the story, right?
Yeah, exactly.
The oil lasted eight days. Right. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
That's right. That's crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And do you do anything like go to temple or anything like that?
No, again, because it's not
a religious
holiday. There's nothing special in terms of, you know, traditions. I used to go to church like way back
when I was when I was a little kid. But, you know, I always used to look forward to it because they'd give us a little Christmas tree.
Yeah.
And I would water it for the first month, maybe 2 months, and then it would die 3 months in.
Yeah.
So, like, my tree never made it past the infant stage. But I went, like, religiously to get that tree, but it just didn't always work out. But the best was we'd go on Christmas Eve, you know, midnight or, you know, 5 o'clock, whatever it was. And you'd get to open one gift at night, and then we usually do our gifts in the morning. But my favorite thing is just like spending time with the family, doing like Christmas Eve dinner, and then we all go to a movie every Christmas. And the funny thing is, we always have to decide. You know, there's my parents and my brother and myself, and there's very eclectic tastes in movies, you know, for the four of us. Yeah. My dad likes, like, a lot of foreign films. He likes a lot of, like, pretty, like, you know, profound movies, whereas, like, I like special effects and, like, I like, you know, animated stuff. And I also like those movies, but it's really interesting to, like, last year we saw Spotlight. That was mm-hmm. the big movie that we saw on Christmas. And I think this year we're going to try and see Jackie, which is one of the movies. Have you seen, by the way, have you seen Rogue One yet?
Nope. No. I went to, so funny good. Thing, I went to, we're in a holiday schedule here, so I got plenty of, you know, repeats. So yesterday I got off early, so I went to the movies, and I thought, ah, great, you know, like 2:30 in the afternoon,
yeah.
I'm going to see Rogue One.
Yes.
Yeah, no lines, nothing. But unfortunately, the screening wasn't until an hour later, so I went to see Arrival instead.
Oh, was that good?
Yeah, I liked it. I liked it.
I heard, I've seen two movies during, you know, winter. I saw Moana because it was hyped mm-hmm. as like one of the best animated movies. And then I saw Rogue One. I went in with very low expectations for the Star Wars movie. It is real good.
I heard.
Like the last hour is probably one of the best hours in Star Wars.
Actually, yeah, I'm waiting for it. I know because, I mean, last year's Episode 8 was a big disappointment. It was successful.
Oh, you were disappointed with it?
Yeah. Because I really had, you know, hopes for it, just like everybody else. And it felt like New Hope all over again. They rebooted. Right.
That's
just
true.
Like they do every other
I
movie
wasn't
now.
Blown away with it, but it was better than the first three, so I was relieved with, like Phantom Menace, I think after the Star Wars movies came out, to have Phantom Menace, I was so bummed about that movie. But, so it was better than Phantom Menace, and it was better than some of I like three a lot, but it was better than that. Yeah. Rogue One, I think you're going to like a lot.
Yeah. Actually, it was Episode 7 last week.
Episode 7.
And Rogue One is kind of like, this is why they call it a Star Wars story.
Yeah.
Because it's not Han Solo, it's not Luke Skywalker, it's nothing that like that. It's the in-between.
It's right before 4.
Exactly. And you got the reference, of course, in New Hope when she says a lot of agents died to get the plans.
Yep.
So I like the premise of it. So
the premise is great because it's you didn't think there'd be a movie based on that, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So but it's really well done. Yeah. Like I love that whole, like, even just going to a Star Wars movie,
exactly,
it's just awesome.
Exactly.
I mean, there's nothing like
I can say that I'm old enough, I've seen the original trilogy in the movies, you know. I was my the first one, New Hope. My older sister took me, and then, you know, as I got older, I could, you know, go and watch it myself. But I saw the original trilogy, so you know,
I never saw one in the theater until I was older when they re-released them.
Yeah.
But I saw Empire Strikes Back in the theater. But the one I really remember seeing in the theater was Return of the Jedi.
Oh,
and that is probably my favorite one of the three.
Yeah, I agree.
But it's just, all three of those first ones are amazing. The thing that bums me out is George Lucas hasn't released the original versions without this added scenes.
The theatrical.
He won't do it.
Yeah.
He won't do it. So when Disney bought Star Wars, they decided to release the original versions because they knew that a lot of people were pissed about it, and they could make more money doing it.
Because,
you know what I mean?
Because you had, he released, I think, the 25-year version, so he fixed the graphics, which I understand. Yeah. That's nice. Yeah. But then another release when he CGI'd Yoda, I mean, seriously.
Yeah.
That's blasphemy. I mean, you can't do that.
I agree. And Jabba the Hutt, too.
Yeah.
You know, and, like, it was weird because, like, for me, Jabba the Hutt in, which one was it? I think it was Empire Strikes Back. When they showed Jabba the Hutt, in Return of the Jedi, Jabba the Hutt is evil. He's like this, like, looming presence. In Empire Strikes Back, he's a kind of a wimp.
Yeah.
And he, like, they, the way they kind of, like, computer generated him, he didn't have that presence, you know?
Exactly.
And you know what? There's nothing like those, the Muppets or like the, you know,
of
like,
of course.
There's nothing that you can't replace.
I mean,
that.
Yoda, all the characteristics. Yes. And of course, Frank Oz did his voice and Fozzie Bear. Yep. I mean, how can you?
Oh, I didn't know he did Fozzie Bear too.
Yes, yeah. Same guy. Oh. And if you remember,
he did Yoda and Fozzie Bear?
Yeah.
That is crazy.
Yep. And if you remember Blues Brothers, remember the movie? Yep. That scene when I think Jake He comes out of prison, and there's this prison guard who gives him all the stuff, like the watch and whatnot, and he says, one condom soiled. That's Frank Oz, by the way.
That's crazy.
Yeah, that's him.
I didn't know that.
He did a cameo.
Dude, what a range. Fozzie and Yoda, that's like iconic.
Because if you listen to the voice, you get, I mean, if you compare it, you'll get it. I mean, it's the same voice.
And you know what? Yoda's voice, like everything, his vibe, like his terminology, it's just like when he speaks, you can't help but pay attention. Yeah. You know what I mean?
So and the classic, do or do not try. I heard that now you can find those on fortune cookies.
Really?
Yeah.
I love it. I need a Star Wars fortune cookie. See, you know what's cool is like you light up when we start talking about Star Wars. You go back to that kid in you.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what makes it awesome.
Yeah, exactly. So that's why I really waited for Rogue One.
Do your kids play with Star Wars toys?
We hardly had any in Israel. It's not like here you see all those action figures. We hardly had any over there.
But
it's
now like usually, you have so much access to them.
Yeah.
So you must, there's got to be a part of you that's like, hey, let me borrow that Millennium Falcon real quick.
Yeah, I did have a 3D puzzle. I think I still have it in Israel in the box. 3D puzzle of the Millennium Falcon. It was awesome. But I only got it when I was an adult. And now my oldest daughter, she's 8, she's like, hey, Dad, what's, let's see Star Wars. So I tell her, okay, it's going to be a little scary. Okay, then go. Yeah.
I saw something today that I didn't want to see because now I want it. It's a drone X-Wing fighter.
Oh.
And it looks awesome. I mean, it looks just like an X-Wing fighter, and it flies like a drone.
Nice.
And I was just thinking, I want that. Yeah. I don't need that. There's no need for that.
Of course.
I don't need it at all, but I want that. You know, so it was like the little kid in me just came out. Anyways, it looks like our special guest has arrived, Mr. Andreas Jablonka. Say hello.
Hello, guys. How are you?
Oh! Our studio audience loves you already.
Thank you very much for having me.
Of course. So you just got in from Thailand. You've been living out there for about 7 months? 7 months?
5-6 months.
Six months. And you've been working on... So tell us what you've been working on. You're a visual effects supervisor, correct?
That's correct.
And you've been working on some Lego... Why don't you talk to us about the features you've been working on?
In Thailand, I worked on a CG animation for Lego. The thing we just finished was for Disney, actually, a Lego version of Frozen.
Yep.
It just aired on the Disney Channel. You can watch this on YouTube. It's 22 minutes. It's called Disney Frozen Northern Lights. There's a bunch more of those coming. And it's basically a Lego version of the original Tales. And we worked on some other stuff like Lego City and Lego Friends, which are all basically commercials for the practical sets. And it's been an interesting change of pace working on that, as I normally work more on feature films or commercials here in Los Angeles.
Yeah, you've done a lot. Let's talk a little bit about your feature films. So you've worked on X-Men, right?
X-Men First Class.
That's one of my favorite ones,
yeah,
by the way.
I agree.
That's one of the best ones. You did Tim Burton's Alice in Wonderland.
Correct.
Right? You did Pirates of the Caribbean.
Two and three.
That's right.
It was actually my first Academy Award, yeah.
That's crazy.
You got an Academy Award?
It's all a teamwork, not me personally.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
But I worked on two shows that won Academy Awards, which was Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Man's Chest, and The Golden Compass, and on five other shows that were nominated: Alice in Wonderland, Rise of the Planet of the Apes, X-Men First Class, Pirates of the Caribbean, At World's End, and I'm forgetting one. The Golden Compass, yeah.
Wow.
I mean, that is, you know, the funny thing is, I met this guy at a car wash. And we started talking Star Wars. I don't know if you remember.
I'm wearing a Star Wars t-shirt.
And he was like, I was like, what do you do? He's like, I'm an artist. I do visual effects. I'm like, anything I've seen? He's like, Harry Potter, X-Men, Alice in Wonderland. I was like, oh, my God, you're my hero. I love all those movies. Those are like some of my favorite
movies.
That's
a resume.
Yeah, that's a resume, right? It's crazy. So let's go way back now to little Andreas. How did you get into this world? What was the first trigger that kind of made you want to do this?
Well, fitting with the theme of the show, Star Wars was definitely one of the first triggers. I was not old
enough
to see
which one?
In the theater. I did see the re-releases. Was the New Hope Special Edition was the first one I saw in the theater. And I always wanted to do big Hollywood movies. And by the time I was age 15, I started doing some rudimentary computer graphics. I bought some 3D programs and learned them. Photoshop was developing. And I thought, okay, that's something I would really like to pursue. So I learned some 3D, first very simple stuff, like I modeled an Enterprise, which was basically a bunch of flattened spheres and cylinders and stuff like that, and did some 3D letters for school presentations, and just learned graphics in general. And then when I was done with what you guys would call junior college, I grew up in Germany, so we called it gymnasium. I went to a private film school that was a hybrid of traditional filmmaking and CGI. So I learned hand-drawn 2D animation like they do at Disney on light tables. I learned 3D animation as they do at Pixar. And finally, what I specialized in is compositing, which is the process of combining real and unreal elements into a wholesome one so it looks like it was filmed in the same location at the same time with the same camera, combining the computer stuff with the real photography.
Wow.
Like, give us an example of a scene for our listeners just to know, like, what's like a perfect example that's like a, from a film that maybe you worked on.
I can talk about it a bit more generically. What you people see when you see a background behind the scenes thing is blue screens or green screens. The idea about that is that you can take out the blue or green and replace it with quote-unquote anything. You do this for three different reasons. Either because it's too expensive to film somebody for real in space or on a volcano. It might be too dangerous to do this with your highly top-built star. Or it just might be impossible in the case of space. So it gives you a lot of freedom. That's one of the simple examples is you shoot it on a green screen, you put your spaceship battle behind it, and it looks interesting. Then you can do CG integration. As you talk about Star Wars, so you have characters like Yoda, you have spaceships, you have environments. You can just make a bigger vision. The idea or the job of a visual effects supervisor is to take a director's vision and make it come true, decide which parts you're going to do practical, like you talked about puppets earlier. These were called animatronics. And in those infancy ages, there was no big visual effects. Let me quick talk about the difference between special effects and visual effects.
Yeah.
Special effects is everything you do on a film set, fire, explosion, pyrotechnics. Mm-hmm. Visual effects is everything you do after the filming has finished and you do it in the computer. That's a distinction.
And the crazy thing is for visual effects, I think it's way more labor intensive than most special effects, ironically, because there's so many details, there's so many pixels, it takes so many, it's so many for like even 15 seconds, it could take weeks just to get that 15 seconds right exactly the way it needs to be.
I worked on 34 feature films, and most of the time I would say I created between 10 seconds to maybe a minute in each of those movies, and that might have taken me 3 to 6 months to do.
Wow.
Because you noodle every aspect of it. And it takes a long time. Ironically, you hear fix it in post. Directors used to try to get the image they want in camera on set. It's not the case anymore. Digital filmmaking has switched this, where you can just let your cameras run and we can fix nearly anything in post nowadays.
I heard.
Which also leads to us having to fix stuff.
Right.
Easy example is when a boom operator shows his mic. Right, this is called a paint out. That is pretty easy for me to do. Half an hour, maybe an hour, it's gone.
Wow.
This is much cheaper than reshooting a scene. Yeah, this is what it really comes down to. On a big Hollywood film set, you're looking at $100,000 to $150,000 US dollars per day.
Wow.
Shooting. So if a big explosion scene has to be redone, this might take them 4 hours to do. This is much more expensive than just fixing it in post and have somebody roto and paint for a week that might only cost $50,000.
Wow.
So oftentimes it's a bit of laziness, but it's still cheaper fixing it later.
I heard that nowadays you can even display nudity. And I heard on...
easy there, buddy.
No. Seriously, Game of Thrones? A lot of those nudity scenes are basically not. I mean,
really?
Don't
break my heart now.
Is in post. Those tits that you see, some of them are not real. Or they're fixed in post.
Right.
I don't know.
Well, in general, it's HBO does Game of Thrones, so they don't have to abide by broadcast standards where you can't show nudity or anything R-rated. So, but it's possible nowadays. Give you an example: Spider-Man 3, the hated Spider-Man that nobody loved. when Venom attacked Tobey Maguire, and you see he rips his shirt off, he has all these abs. Well, he didn't. It's CGI.
Yeah.
It was not working out, so they added
really?
CGI six pack. So it's basically we can do all of it. It's
Star crazy.
Wars. Very often we have to splice takes. The director might like what an actor did with one hand, but he didn't like the other hand. I had to chop off an arm and track in a different arm from a different take.
Or that's wild.
Like wow. You take out blinks, or you make people young or old or fat or skinny.
And so you use the image that's there and then distort it? Or do you have like a data bank of all kinds of brown, white, yellow, red arms that are, you know what I mean, that are severed or something, you know?
I would say most of the time you use existing photography. Sometimes when you have something, let's say Green Lantern, for instance, when you know you have a character that needs full CGI augmentation or what's called digi-doubles, where Superman has to fly, so unless you see clearly it's the actor doing it, you will have a digital model of the actor. So then you can easily choose if you want to render something in CG, computer graphics, or if you want to use an existing arm, for instance, from plate photography. You don't really have a library of this stuff, but you might have high-res photography you've taken for reference purposes. If you need a CG double, oftentimes they take what's called a light stage. It's about 48 cameras around them, so you do a 3D scan of the object to really rebuild an actor. Pretty expensive, but for a lot of movies you need that. And then you have high-res photography of, you know, skin, hair, and all of this stuff, and you can rebuild that. It really depends if you're doing stuff just on the 2D side in compositing, where it's more or less just grab something else from a different shot, or if you're going for the whole CG route. Like on Fast and the Furious 7, when Paul Walker died, filming wasn't done. So they actually went to Weta Digital in New Zealand and had a lot of shots actually that were shot with his brother as a stand-in, completely have a face replacement done in CG. A lot of the shots were completely CG. And I would say nobody really noticed because it's really well done.
That's crazy.
How about movies like Planet of the Apes or Lord of the Rings when they did Gollum? It was Andy Serkis, right? They played the character.
Yeah,
they put
amazing.
All those markers on him.
So in Lord of the Rings, which was now pretty old, he was doing reference takes. He had a Lycra suit on and he had dots on his face. This is referred to as facial motion capture, which is a computer knows where each dot is, and if it moves, it tracks the movement, and it can assign a vector, which is a number, to put this onto a digital model. In this case, he did a take where he was in it, did whatever he did, then he would step out of the plate, and the actors had to remember it, do it again, and then they put in Gollum as a CG creature in it. While, for instance, on Rise of the Planet of the Apes, which was also done at Weta, that I worked on, Andy Serkis was inside the shot in a gray suit with this camera you saw for the facial motion capture, and he was not removed. We had to paint him out of every shot and replace him with the ape, Caesar.
Wow.
Which was a pain in the ass to do.
When you say they make the measurements, can you still make adjustments to them? Like, can you tweak them?
It's really...
Or you don't want to because the performance is there?
You kind of don't. The idea is that you have a static mesh that the computer knows where each pixel is on his face, and when it moves, it's a matter of difference. If you smile, your angles here go up, and the computer knows that basically these pixels have to go up a certain amount. This gets mapped onto a 3D geometry, so you can become the Hulk or you can become a chicken. It doesn't really matter as long as you know which bone goes where, so to speak.
That is wild.
The idea why they're doing it so the performance of the actor comes through.
Yeah.
This is actually a big topic. Andy Serkis has been campaigning very strongly that he feels he deserves an Academy Award for the role of Caesar, that he is acting, therefore it's his attribute. While normally the Academy has the stance, this is a computer-generated character that does not deserve an Academy Award nomination. He pissed off a lot of us visual effects people because he says it's digital makeup, it's all him, when in fact this was not true. Weta has about 80 motion editors, people that done nothing but clean up these motion capture curves for this to work, and animators going over it, even enhancing movements, making them clearer. When it's clearly driven by the actor's performance, it's not just them. So to a certain degree, if you're saying he deserves an Oscar for this performance, then all the visual effects artists who work on these characters also deserve this Oscar nomination.
Yeah, but it kind of fell on deaf ears because most people in the industry know that it is a team effort, you know? But he was just, he was barking pretty loud.
Well, you see this in the bake-offs right now. The way it goes is every branch of the Academy has a specialized team that knows these issues. So when the big visual effects Oscar nominations just came out, they start with 20 movies that they compiled. Then everybody does a presentation. The companies that do these movies do a presentation called a bake-off, in which the Academy branch for visual effects, which are knowledgeable people, like me, like you, like others, that know what's going on. They value, yeah, this was good, this was average, this was pushing boundaries, and then they boil it down to the contender list. I think, like this year, for instance, I think Hugo Strange yeah. should win, in my opinion, because this was really, pun intended, mind-bending visuals that came right. out of that. The Jungle Book, on the other hand, would be the other big favorite because it really blends the graphics well to the point where I could sometimes not tell when the set ended and the wow. computer graphics started, and that's a really big feat. But what I was saying is basically this list gets created by the professionals, and then the whole of the Academy votes. So suddenly you have to, no offense, 65-year-old white actor that does not know a thing about what a pixel actually
right,
is.
Right.
So he just says, it's a talking animal, I like it. That's why the Golden Compass won over Transformers that year, when it was for sure that the Transformers, which looked amazing, would take the Oscar. No, it was a little talking demons that persuaded a bunch of the Academy. So when you're saying most people know that it was digital makeup and there was more to it than just that, no, I disagree.
They don't know.
The 65-year-old white guy does not know that.
Andy Serkis just monkeying around, right? Jeez. So let me ask you this. You showed me some things on your reel. We won't say which actor it was, but it was interesting. He showed me one scene, and in one of the movies he worked on, he said this actor didn't want to get wet. And there was a scene where the actor was, I guess, writing on a device, and it was raining. And it was crazy because it looked like he was just getting wet like crazy, traveling through the rain. And had he not told me that the rain was totally fake, wow. I would not have known it. You know what I mean? So
thank you.
No, really, it was really awesome. It's one of the things that stands out on your reel to me when I remember seeing it. When you get a request like that, is there a part of you and your team that are like, seriously?
The big face palm definitely happens when you get the briefing. You're like, why would yeah. you actually?
You can
not
say you can curse.
Yeah,
don't
it's
worry.
Internet.
You curse?
Okay. Yeah, it definitely happens. I mean, I always joke that if all the directors and supervisors on set would do exactly what we advised them to do, I would have 80% less work. Like, it's only because they're screwed up or don't do it right or change their mind that we have to change so much nowadays. In that regard, there was a different sequence that was shot wet, and that A-list actor did not like the fact that he was sprinkled on with water, so they turned it off. Good example, this was probably a day or two worth of shooting time they would have to redo if we said we can't do it, but it was cheaper for us to add the rain in the composite.
That is crazy. And like, how finicky can directors get with all that stuff? I always wonder that, right, Renan? It's like, how finicky can the director get with special effects? Because
Visual effects, thank you.
I mean, visual effects, that's what I meant, I'm sorry.
It depends a little bit on the actors. Like, some directors are very, very hands-on and have a good understanding. Like James Cameron, for instance, yeah. be it with Avatar or Terminator, knows exactly what he wants. He was a matte painter, he has done work himself, same as Peter Jackson. While others, like Martin Scorsese, for instance, lets his visual effects people do a lot of work and present it to him because he's not as technical. And he relies more on the expertise of the people, which is nice. So, for instance, on Alice in Wonderland, Tim Burton, I would not decide on a certain aspect of the show of the Jabberwocky, this big monster, had this mist coming off him. So we literally had to do the sequence twice, once without this mist, and then only at the end would he decide. So it really varies. But overall, if the director wants to change something, he will probably get it, no matter if we have to stay till 3 a.m.
And is there a debate between the studios too? Like, maybe yes. the director wants something, but the studio maybe doesn't want to pay for it. Or maybe the studio wants to pay for something that the director doesn't think is necessary.
Well, the director doesn't pay, right? He has nothing right. to do with the money. He has a producer who keeps them in check, hopefully, that says, no, we changed this 50 times, this is it. But very often, the approval stage is normally your visual effects supervisor, or me in that case with the proof of shot. It goes to the production, their visual effects supervisor might approve it, then it goes to the director who approves it. And very often, you have a studio approval. Like Fox, for instance, does this very often. I won't say that they don't trust their directors as much, but very often they have a certain approval stage on top of that where they're vetoing things, where directors say, oh, this needs to be different. They go like, no, this is fine, leave it. Or the opposite around. So they're not often or not always in sync, but normally you try to fulfill the director's vision. He's your ultimate client. And if he wants something different, then the producers have to battle it out. If it's an overage, meaning it's very different from the initial brief, it deserves extra money, or it's just slightly different. If you want to change the color of your dinosaur to a bit more blue, it's not a big deal. If you suddenly want a completely different dinosaur, that is a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the constant battle. It goes back and forth. Which brings me to the business model of our industry is kind of broken. We're doing what's called a flat bid, which means the analogy always is when you want to build a house, you say, I want three bedrooms, two stories, build me this. The contractor goes, okay, cool, it's going to cost you, I don't know, $500,000. And then suddenly in the middle of the construction, you say, I want another story, I want to add two more bedrooms. Then the contractor goes like, okay, that's going to delay it and it's going to cost more money. And you would understand this makes sense. Well, in visual effects, they go, oh, by the way, we want 5,000 more spaceships, but we have no more money, and the movie still has to come out on the same day because we already burned $150 million. $150 million of marketing. Imagine
right.
if Star Wars didn't come out on that day, the world would stop.
Right. Right. Right.
So this is often where the studios then go, well, you need to pay us more. And they go like, well, do you still want to work with us? Because we can take this to a different studio and you will never get work from us again. They go like, okay, fine, we'll suck it up and we'll do it
wow.
anyway. That's why when I worked at Weta, for instance, we worked 115 hours a week.
Wow.
8 in the morning to 2 in the morning, 7 days a week. You're done after a while. Pirates of the Caribbean, same thing. I worked at the orphanage in San Francisco, I think 90 hours a week.
Jeez.
Not all the time, but it's pretty common at the end.
But the quality of work after you're doing maybe 10 hours.
10 hours is a standard day in visual effects. We start at 10.
Well, I'm saying like when I do a record, for example, like, you know, I've done 15-hour sessions consistently back to back. But my quality of work from hour 11 to 15 is not even close to 1 to 10. Not even close.
That is true. But if your producer says, Nicky, but your album has to be live at the record
right.
studio in 3 days, I
right.
don't care if it's
then
done.
You do it. You just... you.
unfortunately,
a lot of espresso.
Exactly. This is the same here. That's one when the movie still needs 300 effect shots instead of a week to go, what are you going to do? You can add more people, which you might or might not be able to do. You might not have as many computers or space in your facility.
Right.
Or you put them on overtime, which exactly as you say, the quality goes down. But there's not much you can do about that.
Hmm.
Because every other department gets to delay their stuff. Visual effects is normally the last step in the process that needs to fix it. Like, oh, you remember that stunt? I worked on like a Live Free or Die Hard, for
right.
instance.
Right.
And they shot a rocket at a big truck going on a psych. It was supposed to tip onto two wheels, looking cool, coming back. Well, guess what? The truck fell over. So they came back with, can you make it not fall over? And we're like, but it fell over. Yeah, we can't have this. The truck's damaged. We can't reshoot it. So we had to warp and reconstruct all this plate so the truck didn't fall over.
I now have to watch that movie again just to see that scene. But you know what the crazy thing is? I think you said it. It's like when you can pull off the feat of us not knowing
yes.
that something like that was done, then you know. Does it ruin movies for you? When you go into a movie, like you're obviously going to see, you're going to see Star Wars tomorrow.
Yes.
So you're going to see the visual effects and any kind of CGI in a very different way than if I go see that movie.
I see it a different way that I see more than you probably don't see, but the reward is still the same. If I'm not getting jacked out of the movie by something being done terribly, I still enjoy it, even though I see it. It's really more when the effects are bad, when I basically go like, wow, this made it into a final movie, this is horrible, which still sometimes happens on A-list movies. Star Wars, probably not, because it's a Disney property and had huge amounts of money behind it. But there's still movies where, like Captain America, the first one when it came out, had some pretty dodgy effects in it.
Right.
I was really surprised that even for a $150 million movie, there were some pretty bad effects in it. It doesn't ruin the movies for me. It's just, I watch it with a different... I guess I watch it on both a craftsman level and a fan. It's probably the same
yeah.
with you music guys. You can hear a song if you like the song, and then you can go like, yeah, but that mix sucks, or
yeah,
that,
yeah.
I don't know, drum set is drowned out or something like that. So you can probably distinguish the two.
Yeah, yeah. And I definitely listen like that
yeah.
a lot. Like, but it's amazing when you can see something that works on both. And then that's the magic, the marvel.
That's kind of how I felt about The Jungle Book. Basically, I know for a fact that they shot it with a little boy in front of blue screen with a little bit of mud and whatever. And normally I can very easily see where a stage ends, the green screen starts, and where it's extended. The Jungle Book blended this beautifully where sometimes I couldn't tell.
Well, Favreau rented a huge warehouse in downtown LA
yeah, so.
And built the entire set, like the CGI green screen, just so the models were there.
He built a green screen, and he built probably as much mud that fills this room, and that was it. It was nothing particularly big.
I thought there were models that the kid can run on, like the tree branches.
Let's say like probably as big as this room, maybe a little bit bigger, like a little bit of mud, but not that much.
That's crazy.
Yeah. So like enough for the kid to basically not step on blue or green, like what the Star Wars prequels we talked about, was a lot of people standing in green rooms and had no point of reference. That's where they get very frustrated. He had a little bit more to interact with, but it wasn't as much as you see in the final movie. That's exactly why I was very happy that they blended this so well. I couldn't sometimes tell if this ground was particularly real or not. One interesting fact about Star Wars, since we talked about it, is that John Knoll actually wrote the story for Rogue One. John Knoll is the head creative at ILM, Industrial Light and Magic, and he's also the co-creator of Photoshop. So he was a Star Wars fan, and he was the one who actually pitched the story to Kathleen Kennedy for Rogue One, saying, hey, you always heard in A New Hope that how did the rebels get the plans? This sounds like an interesting story to me. And he was actually one who wrote this. So a visual effects geek now actually made, hopefully, a good Star Wars movie. Earlier you guys were talking about it, I put fingers in my ears since I didn't want to hear any spoilers. But yeah, it's interesting that basically now, finally, the geek revolution has begun a little bit, where we can actually make movies, and hopefully this will lead to better products.
Oh, I think it already has.
And
go ahead.
They brought back Tarkin, right? What's his name?
Moff Tarkin. But
yeah, Moff Tarkin.
Spoiler free, I don't know too much about it. If you tell me, I have to kill you.
What do you mean? Well, no, it's just that the actor died, in the 90s. Yeah. So they had to kind of reconstruct or redo the character.
Yeah, it's not the first time we have done that. I mean, oftentimes you take previous plates, map them onto the three-dimensional model of the person, and then make them talk. It's a good achievement when it looks good, but it's... won't play it down. It will probably look great. But as I say, we've done this with Paul Walker before. You've done this with Marlon Brando and a lot of other actors. So it's something, what's the usual? That sounds so negative, but it's commonplace by now.
Now, let's go back real quick. You said you were a 15-year-old kid. You learned all these programs. Then what was the step after high school? Like, what made you say, okay, this is what I want to do, and this is how I'm going to go about it?
I think I kind of decided that at the age of 15, this is what I wanted to do. And so I finished my schooling and went to this hybrid film school, called the German Film School for Digital Production, where we learned both the traditional filmmaking side. I wrote storyboards, treatments, camera, lighting, model making. We actually made like a Mars landscape and had a motion control camera fly over it. We did motion control, all of this stuff, and computer animation. And then I was done and had my own little company with my buddy in Germany for 2 years called Thinking Pixels. But we were always doing a lot of web design and smaller stuff. I wanted to do big Hollywood movies, so I packed my bags and moved to Los Angeles. And foolishly thought, hey, I'm that great. I know all the software on the planet. It will be easy to find a job. 3 months later, I was a little disencouraged. And
LA can do that to you.
Yeah, I started with, I'm going to be working at Disney or ILM or Digital Domain. And at the end, I literally applied at any TV station that had a small graphics department. And it took, I said, 3-4 months before I found a job.
But that's how you cut your teeth. That's how you do the work and learn, you know. There's a learning curve a little bit.
That was exactly that. I knew all the software on the planet, but I had no production experience. So I was fortunate enough that I started at LookFX in Hollywood. They had an office above the El Capitan Theater on Pirates of the Caribbean 2 as a rotoscope artist. A rotoscope artist is the guy that masks out frame by frame an individual that's not in front of a green screen so he can put something behind it. ILM was outsourcing this work and literally had all these boats of pirates running back and forth in craziness when this Kraken attack happens, and we just made masks so the Kraken could go behind something. I worked on a Keira Knightley shot that had just shaved her hair for the movie Domino, where she was a headhunter or bounty hunter, and so she was wearing this wig that was flowing in the wind, and I had to mask this frame by frame just so ILM could put this tiny little island somewhere on the horizon later. And I saw the final movie, I felt like, this is a week of my life for 20 pixels of island. Thank you very much.
That's going to be a little frustrating sometimes.
It was. I mean, I'm not going to lie, the paychecks helped,
right?
And the fact it was Pirates of the Caribbean, I'm a big Pirates fan. So that was definitely a cool start. After I worked on Rocky Balboa, which was cool. sometimes you meet your hero, sometimes not. I met Sylvester Stallone, and that was pretty cool because I'm 6'4", pretty big guy, and I was wearing
Ivan
Drago t-shirt. He's pretty short. And he came in, he looked at me like, you're a tall fella, aren't you? I was like, oh, this is the lowest, great way to feel. He nearly broke my hand because the dude is buff.
Wow.
Yeah. And it's very common. Like, we did Rocky Balboa when he was in his 50s, maybe even 60s at this point already. Mm-hmm. So everybody asked us, did we beautify him? Did we paint out veins, everything? Nope, this is all completely him. He actually wanted to look real. It was interesting because the dude is still so buff, he could break you in half if he wants to.
So that was, that's nuts.
Yeah.
Now, were there any directors that, I mean, you've worked with some great directors. Are there any directors that you're dying to work with?
That I'm dying to work with? Now you put me on the spot. I think Martin Scorsese would be pretty cool because I really like his work.
I was hoping you were going to say that.
I met a couple. I met Tim Burton. I met James Cameron. I met Sylvester Stallone. So I think Michael Bay would be interesting. Michael Bay has a very spotty reputation for how he treats his crew. He yells at them, he curses at them, he fires them on the spot. On the other hand, as much as I'm a big Transformers fan,
right,
and so even though the movies really don't hit what I want out of a Transformers movie, I'm happy that he is making Transformers movies. So to a certain degree, it would be interesting to meet Michael Bay and see, like, is he just rubbing other people the wrong way? Would he yell at me too? Or would you be like, this is awesome stuff, thank you?
I'm surprised you didn't say Jon Favreau, Iñárritu. I think he's a fantastic director. But he's doing more, cinematography, stuff like that. But I think there's room for all of these directors that, like Jon Favreau's Jungle Book, I never thought in a million years he would do a movie like that and make it look like
that. Well, nobody also didn't think that he made the movie Chef. And
that's the movie about the guy who
he sells his restaurant.
Yeah, goes on the food truck with his kid. Yep. I liked it.
I really liked the movie. Just rubbed me the wrong way for the reason that I'm actually a chef too. I went to culinary school.
I saw that
and wanted to open my own food truck.
He's got a tattoo
that says "Good food for life."
And so it's a little bit of a, it rubs me the wrong way because twice in the movie he gets handed opportunities. He gets handed a food truck, and later a guy says, like, hey, let me finance your new restaurant. Well, I tried to get my food truck off the ground for months with no bank even being interested in reading the freaking business plan. So it's like, people are like, oh, you should totally do it like Jon Favreau. It's like, cool, you have a food truck for me? No, then shut up.
Yeah, that's got to be a little bit frustrating. Yeah. When you're watching a special effects...
Visual effects.
I haven't had my caffeine today. When you're watching visual effects in movies, is there a particular visual effects supervisor or artist that you're consistently mesmerized with?
There's a lot of them. I mean, I had the benefit of working with Ken Ralston. Ken Ralston won his Academy Award for The Empire Strikes Back, then Roger Rabbit. I worked with him on Alice in Wonderland, and the guy is a genius. He's not the easiest to work with, but he knows exactly what he wants. John Knoll would be amazing to work with as well. I hadn't had the pleasure of that happening yet. Dennis Murren at ILM was definitely one of the greats. He's now taking a bit of a step back. But there's definitely a bunch of supervisors out there that I like working with. In general, I prefer supervisors that don't do a lot of pixel fucking, that really look at, hey, you said I can curse.
You can.
That really see the big picture and try to make a good movie, as opposed to, very often happens that the supervisors are the ones who polish something beyond the stage where the audience will see it, where even the director will see it. We go like 20% of the work is wasted just because you wanted to do something on this tiny little speck that nobody will see. On one hand, sure, you want quality. On the other hand, you also don't want to kill your people over something that is pretty trivial. So I think the good supervisors have a good balance. That's what I'm trying to do when I supervise my crew. Then I go like, do I really mind? Does it need to get fixed, or is it fine? Because if you blink, then it's gone.
And like I'm sure most people don't know this, but on average, what's the size of a crew for a feature length versus maybe what you're doing in Thailand versus maybe a commercial? Because you've done kind of all three of those spectrums.
It happens. It varies by budget. So give an idea, like if you have a 30-second commercial and it's normal visual effects work, meaning you might have a green screen, you have something that needs to get painted out, you probably have a crew of 10 people. And it's probably taking them 3 weeks, 2 weeks, 4 weeks to do. On the other hand, if you have a big Hollywood blockbuster like you know, Rogue One or Captain America or things like that, you might have a crew of 3,000 visual effects workers spread across 5 to 10 visual effects companies all over the world working on this for a year.
Just so they can do this.
Most of the time, this is pyro, which happens on set, which is special effects.
Don't ruin it for me. Don't ruin it for me.
But didn't they what was that Stallone movies? The Expendables.
Yeah.
Everything there was, the explosions and everything was CGI, isn't it? And
it's a mix of both. Yeah. Oftentimes, for instance, the blood was CGI because it's nowadays a lot easier to do blood splatters in CG than have an actual blood squid that you have on a character that you have to paint out. The audiences expect more quality nowadays. So yeah. If you look at like old Die Hard movies, you see very clearly where a wire harness was attached under a shirt or where a blood squid was on a body. For those days, it was fine. Nowadays, audiences would not accept this anymore. So digital explosions, digital blood has become more and more normal. Like, Expendables was mainly done at Worldwide Effects in Shreveport, Louisiana. They probably had a crew of, I would say, like 80 to 150 people on that. And it was a lower budget production. I don't know exact numbers. I would guess $40 to $80 million as opposed to $150 million. And it's also a matter of time. Do you have 3 months to finish a movie or do you have a whole year? Like, when they did Avatar, James Cameron basically had the whole of Weta, like 800 to 1,000 people, for 4 years to do it. And people bitched at him, like, oh, my God, it cost $300 million to make. Dapper was the most expensive movie of all time. We're like, well, it made over $1 billion. So there you go.
Yeah.
That's why he's planning 4 more sequels.
Of that movie?
Yes.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Four more Avatars are coming.
Too much.
Too much.
Well, he actually moved to New Zealand. He bought a whole farm there.
But it looks like any movie nowadays, I don't know, maybe Woody Allen wouldn't, but every movie you got visual effects, right? Even
absolutely.
You mentioned in Naruto on The Reverence, right?
Yes.
That scene with the bear.
Yes.
I mean, when I saw how it was done, I was like, wow.
It's crazy.
I realized it wasn't a real bear,
but when
you see it, how it's done, you say, and you know, when you see the result, it's impressive, very impressive.
I have two questions too. Mm-hmm. I remember in like the 80s and 90s they used blue screen, and now it's all green screen. Mm-hmm. Why the change in the colors?
The change in the colors came mainly because now we're doing films digitally. Blue was used because it was the furthest away from skin tones, so it's easy to distract. The way chroma keying works, it's called color separation or color difference matting. You want to, in those days, basically different film was exposed and developed for different chemicals, splitting out the different dyes. You had like silver brom oxide in your blue channel, which is the little sizzly crystals you see. And nowadays, digital cameras are very light susceptible. Our eyes see green brighter than any other color. Hmm. So when you hear red, green, and blue, RGB, digital cameras have twice as many pixels for green, for brightness. That's why green is easier to light. You need less light to make it bright. That's it's easier to extract it. That's why green most of the time is more conducive to doing that. It's not an absolute. Oftentimes, it still matters what you put in front of it. So if you're Peter Jackson, you're filming green elves with green screen in front of a green forest, and then you have green screen behind it, it's absolutely useless, but he still did it. While if you would put blue there, it would have basically been easier. So often it's a matter of what do they have available.
So they still use blue then?
They still use blue.
Oh, I didn't know that.
The other movie that we didn't name with this actor who is bald and was A-listing that movie was all shot on black screen.
And his name rhymes with Jim Cecil.
Subtle, yeah, very subtle, yeah.
I still didn't get it.
Vin Diesel.
Yeah, so this was all shot on black screen.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so basically the color itself doesn't really matter. It's a matter of, is it easy for you to separate it from what's in front of
it?
And green being the brightest needs the least amount of light. Lights on set can get pretty hot and pretty expensive, so it's easier to light.
And my other question is, I always notice this when I see movies in the theater and then when I see it on a TV. There is such a big difference.
Depends on what TV you have.
So I was going to ask, is it the projection that shows... It like on a TV, you see how fake it looks, or you see like you know, you almost see the mistakes. You know what I mean?
Yes. So basically, the last step in filmmaking nowadays is called DI, digital intermediate. It's also referred to as color grading. It used to be done at the actual film labs of Godak or Fuji, films getting bleached, bypassed, and spliced and developed to develop certain looks. And then DI happened, I would say, around like 1995, 2000. Like Amelie was one of the first DI movies done at the digitally, and then the Matrix, of course, was the first time where you had visual color coding. Anything in the Matrix was bleached and contrasty in green, while anything in the real world was brown.
Yeah.
So this is done by color grading houses. The big ones at LA are Company 3, eFilm, and there's Laser Pacific and a couple of others. So they have calibrated monitors. They do very precise work in what this is supposed to look like in a controlled environment, which is what their setup looks like. And a good theater, we talked about doing like Grauman's, Laser IMAX.
It's my favorite movie theater.
We argued over that I said the AMC Prime Dolby Vision Theater is a touch above that, not by much. So basically, these are controlled environments. It looks like what it's supposed to look like. And so when basically then you see it at home, your television set is not calibrated.
Right.
When you go to a Best Buy, you see all these televisions competing with each other. And what they do is they crank up dynamic contrast and saturation to the point where it looks bright and impressive, but not realistic. Mm-hmm. A good calibration has a contrast level where you can see the darkest darks and the brightest brights. And it's called a pluge, which, as you can see, the transitions for all of them. It's not just 50% white, then you have all black and you're losing detail. So a good calibration on a good TV you can do at home, or have somebody, a calibrator, come by and do it. While if you just put your TV on, I don't know, movie mode, it might not necessarily be the same. So it's a matter of how much do you care. Do you have, you know, $20 Logitech speakers, or do you have $5,000 Bang & Olufsen setup? Yeah.
Right.
So for TV, when I buy a TV, I'm spending a month researching that and probably have a $4,000 television, while somebody else goes to Costco and buys a $700 LG and is happy with that because it says LED on there.
Right.
Yeah.
Huh.
It's a difference between playing a Marshall, a J45. And
yes.
Or a new, modeling.
But it's about your experience and your, like, how you're going to, like, how your experience in the field, whether you have nothing to do with it or you have a lot to do with it, it's how you are, your perspective changes.
Yeah, absolutely. In what you see, like, you know? For instance, I have like a Dolby uncompressed sound setup at home. I have 7.1 surround DTS HD master, but I wouldn't necessarily hear the difference compared to something else because I'm not as much an audio guy. I listen to a lot of heavy metal, so my highs are gone anyway.
Right.
So basically, I know I wouldn't spend $20,000 on an audiophile setup because I wouldn't hear the difference, yet my eyes are very expensive. I can see the vision. There's color tests out there that actually measure this. And when I taught at Los Angeles Film School, and I can do a color test, basically that I have perfect color vision, quote unquote, that I can distinguish very small different in shades and hues and brightness. A lot of other people go like, that looks green to me. I go like, well, this is actually cyan or turquoise.
Wow.
So while you might say, oh, this is, I don't know, A minor, I go like, for me, it's just loud and pingy.
True.
Okay, real quick, where can people find you if they want to hire you for work?
At the moment, they can find me in Los Angeles. I do have a website, www.jabbaworks.com.
Spell it out, because people are dumb.
JABBAWORKS.com. You can find me on LinkedIn. I'm on IMDb, Internet Movie Database.
Awesome. And then one last question. Five movies that think are the greatest visual effects achievements up to now. Now, you may see the next one tomorrow, but as of right now,
this is like making you choose between 100 children.
Yes, that's true.
I love the Lord of the Rings trilogy. I'm going to count this as one.
That's fine. That's cool.
Forrest Gump was amazing. Roger Rabbit was amazing. Star Wars was definitely in there, as I said before. And I think The Matrix also, because it paved the way
Lot of them. I think the one I was most intrigued by was Roger Rabbit. I wouldn't have thought that would be in your top five.
Roger Rabbit was the first time that you combined animation with computer graphics. You had like the Last Starfighter before, which had a spaceship, but really character animation, which is one of the hardest things you can do. You have eye lines, C lines, where things act, where they touch each other. Character animation is very hard to do right. And Roger Rabbit, I think, worked for the limited tools they had at those time. Again, compliments to Ken Ralston on that for making this all believable. I never once did not believe Roger was alive. Right. That's a big compliment.
Interesting, it was very groundbreaking at the time.
I love that movie too. I still watch it, and I'm like, Jessica man, it's Rabbit, so good. I mean, Jessica Rabbit,
every boy's dream.
Oh yes.
And with that note,
Andreas,
that bombshell,
you were a fantastic guest. Thanks for coming all the way from Thailand to be on the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Of course. And Renan, happy holidays.
Happy holidays.
It's going to be
Christmas,
great,
everybody.
Yeah, and this will be. We're going to do a rerun next week because it's the holidays. It's actually my birthday next week, so I'm taking the night off.
You'll be 18.
We'll see you all. And we'll see you all in 2017.
In the new year.
Yeah, that's right. With a new president too. So strap in. It's gonna be a wild ride. We'll see you next year. Wake up, Hollywood.